So why don't we get started on this week? That was a perfect segue, Judy, because this idea of a holy war or God's war is definitely something we're going to pick up today. We're going to start with chapter 6 today. And the first verse of chapter 6 is, now Jericho is, well, let me read it how I would translate it, okay? Jericho was closed and locked down before the children of Israel. No one was going to be leaving and no one would enter. Okay, now why do I say closed and locked down? Like when I look at my English, it says, now Jericho was shut up tight. Now in the Hebrew, it's actually two different words. It says sogeret umesugeret. Okay, sogeret is closed and misugeret, it was closed. So it's almost as if it's not only that they closed the city gates, it was closed, but that there is this active lockdown that is going on, which you then understand from the end where it says no one can come in and no one can go out. Okay, so it's not just a city where they close the gates, but it is in a lockdown position. And they're doing that, of course, because they're protecting themselves against the children of Israel, which they know will be coming soon. Now, interestingly enough, just a word of background here about the chapters and verses in scripture in general. The assignment of chapters and verses is actually Christian in origin. It goes back to the Middle Ages. There was some priest, I can't remember his name, Father something, who was the one who actually divided the Bible into chapters and verses. The original Jewish tradition definitely had the verses set aside. You knew when every verse began and when every verse ended, but they were not numbered. Okay, so what this priest did was actually give a tremendous contribution, and which is the reason, of course, that we all Christians and Jews follow this chapter and verse numbering system, because it just makes it all so easy to refer to something and you all know what you're talking about. But sometimes there is a different system, though, in the Jewish system. It's a system of paragraphs. Again, the Jews weren't good in numbers, but they did set, they knew where the verse began and where it ended, and they would also set aside paragraphs of sorts. And those paragraphs give you a sense of where a story begins or ends, or a subsection of a story begins or ends. Why am I mentioning that? Because this first verse that is noted as the first verse of chapter 6 in the Jewish paragraph system is actually the last verse of the previous chapter, of the previous paragraph. So basically, traditionally, this verse is not introducing the war of Jericho so much as concluding the story with the angel. Now, I think it's obvious why the priest made it the first verse of chapter 6, because beginning in verse 2 of chapter 6, we start talking about the actual war. We have God speaking to Joshua, giving him an exact instructions how Jericho is going to be captured, and then the actual ceremony that happens, which of course we will review. But here, you know, and I would say if you think about ancient cities, you know, what comes to mind for me is the Roman conquest of Jerusalem in the first century. So Jerusalem was a walled city, a very, very massive wall. Those of you who have been to the old city of Jerusalem, you can see how thick that wall is, you know, and that the lower parts of that wall is the original wall. So you can see what the Romans were up against. And of course, the way the Romans conquered the city, it was a siege that lasts quite some time, similar to this Jericho situation. At some point, the rebels who were in Jerusalem not only closed the city, but did not allow anyone in or out because they were looking for this, you know, cooperation, forced cooperation in this battle or to withstand the Romans. And the Romans then start finding all kinds of ways that they can penetrate the wall. So if I were telling the story of the siege of Jerusalem and the subsequent conquest by the Romans, To start the story with the fact that Jerusalem has closed its gates and locked its people down, that is a very important introduction, because in order to understand the Roman methods, whether it was the battering ram or the catapults or, you know, throwing, you know, burning spears across the wall, all of those methods that they took to battle Jerusalem were a direct result of the fact that the people inside, the Jews inside the wall, closed it up and locked it down, and it was a massive, nearly impenetrable wall. However, if we look at the chapter 6, we will see that there is no battle plan. Actually, there's no battle plan because the nation doesn't actually do battle in Jerusalem. The nation certainly doesn't do anything to ram the walls. The walls tumble down miraculously as God, who really takes care of that one for them. So the fact that Jericho is closed, it doesn't really give us any information that's relevant or significant to the beginning, to the story. Well, it has some significance, but I would argue that it has far more significance to the previous story. So the previous story, as we discussed last week, we have this angel standing above Joshua, standing above Jericho with a sword in his outstretched hand. And his one statement to Joshua, and of course we analyzed it last week also to say that this represented the appointment of Joshua to conquer the land, but his one statement to Joshua is that the place where he is standing is a holy place. And clearly, what place is it he's talking about? He's talking about this encapsulated, enclosed Jericho, okay? And everything that we are going to be able to see now as we continue about Jericho is going to be about this closed, encapsulated place that the angel of God has said is set aside, is different. It is holy. What that holiness means, okay, we'll get to afterwards. But I would also say that if we look at it, not necessarily from the divine perspective, but from the perspective of the king of Jericho, why is he so determined to lock down the city? What do we know about him and how he's viewing things? So first of all, if we go back to Joshua 2, that wonderful chapter of the spies and how they go to Rahab, in chapter 2, of course, they come into Jericho. They're not very successful in keeping a secret, because almost immediately the king of Jericho discovers that he has these spies there. Okay. And so we see in chapter 2, verse 3, the king of Jericho sent orders to Rahab, produce the men who came to you and entered your house, for they have come to spy out the whole country. Now, of course, she hides them and everything, but from his point of view, he learns that there are these two men that have come in to spy in Jericho, and he sends all his people out to chase after them. You would think that these were a major, major threat, okay, to Jericho. Now, that's in contrast, of course, to what we know about Rahab, who says immediately to the people, describing the response that at least some of the people from Canaan had, at wonder at God's amazing power, rescuing them from Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea, and the recent battle against the Amorites. Okay, so if you think about it, we have two possible responses that we know that the word of God's miraculous salvation of Israel and the miraculous defeat and conquest of the Amorites has reached the people of Jericho, has reached the king of Jericho, right? So there's two possible responses, okay? One is Rahab's response. Okay, guys, I'm with you. I realize this is a God that's way beyond anything we can come up against. I'm not about to engage in war against God. I'm with you. Save me. That's Rahab. Here we have the king of Jericho that is exactly the opposite. Not only is he, you know, not accepting any of this stuff, but he is saying, we're closing down, we're locking down, we're preparing for battle. We're getting ready. He's getting ready to do battle with God. That's the king of Jericho. And I may add that this is in contrast to at least the impression that we gain from the first verse in chapter 5, when all the kings of the Amorites on the western side of the Jordan and all the kings of the Canaanites near the sea heard how the Lord had dried up the waters of the Jordan for the sake of Israelites until they crossed over, they lost heart and no spirit was left in them because of the Israelites. You have a sense there that the kings of these other places are like, give up. You know, there's no way we can fight against this. This is way too big for us. And here we have King of Jericho who is saying, no, we're locking down, we're fortifying, we are getting ready for battle. So that tells you something about, and I think that is why this verse also belongs in the previous one. It is the angel of God who is saying this is holy ground, meaning this will be a holy war. This is going to be a place where God will wage battle. And it, the fact that the king of Jericho is close down Jericho is saying, the king is saying, well, I'm battling God. And that's what this battle is about. And we need to keep that in mind as we go on and see some of the other details that unfold before us. Okay, so starting in verse 2, we have God speaking to Joshua, and he tells him, you know, I'm going to be delivering the king and the people and the king of Jericho, all of their soldiers, etc. And he gives them very peculiar instructions, okay? He says, you're going to spend 6 days. Every day, you have a procession. You have 7 priests carrying 7 jubilee trumpets, okay? Then you have the Ark of the Covenant, and then you have these soldiers or whatever, the men, the armed men. And we learn later on, by the way, when it actually happens, that there's this forward force that actually goes, marches before the priests, the people who are going to be the first ones that actually penetrate the wall. But for 6 days, they just go march around the wall once. Each day, 6 days, they march around the wall once, and they carry the trumpets. They blow the trumpets. They're not blowing the trumpets yet. They're just carrying these trumpets, and the trumpets are something they're gonna be blowing. But all they're doing is once a day, going around this wall for 6 days. Now imagine, again, here you have Jericho closed. You have a king that's saying, I'm battling God. And God is really giving them a chance. He's basically saying, you know, if we were thinking we were going to be fighting an ordinary war, we would have our battering arms ready. Okay. They're just circling around with trumpets. This is a message that is saying, this is not going to be an ordinary war. But of course, the king of Jericho isn't listening. So on the seventh day, okay, we have them getting up very early. And on this day, it's going to be very different, because on this day, on the seventh day, they're actually going to circle the wall 7 times, okay? And they're going to actually blow the trumpets. And you can imagine the racket that is going to cause. It's going to all of a sudden blow the trumpets. And Joshua makes it very clear to the people. He says, you know, all those other days, don't make a sound. Don't make a sound, okay? It's just the silent procession. And now he's telling the people, okay, when you hear, this is in verse 16, on the seventh round, on the seventh day, okay? On the seventh round, as the priest blew the horns, Joshua commanded the people, shout, for the Lord has given you the city. So you have this cacophony of trumpets, and people yelling, and it's like crazy, right? But Joshua's statement is very clear. You know, you're not giving yourself the city. You're not going to be the heroes here. God is the one who's going to give the city. But then he gives, before anything happens, okay, he gives them a very interesting and very, in many ways, troubling instruction. And this is verse 6:17. The city and everything in it are to be, in my English, it says prescribed. We're going to be discussing what that word means. Okay. Prescribed for the Lord. Only Rahab the harlot is to be spared, and all who are with her in the house, because she hid the messengers we sent. But you must beware of that which is prescribed, or else you will be prescribed. If you take anything from that which is proscribed, you will cause the camp of Israel to be proscribed. You will bring calamity upon it. All the silver and golden objects of copper and iron are consecrated to the Lord. They must go into the treasury of the Lord. Okay? So we have here, the fact that they cannot take any of the spoils, any of the jewelry or the precious metals, okay? They can't take that. But you also have this idea that the only person that will be saved, that will be able to remain alive, is Rahab and her family, okay? And in case we haven't figured that out, So in other words, that is a very, very clear warning that it's not just that they have to not take the spoils. And it will take, look at verse 21. This is what they actually did. They exterminated everything in the city with the sword, man and woman, young and old, ox and sheep and ass. Okay, now, first of all, this is clearly troubling. I think anytime we learn of a war where people are commanded to not just kill the soldiers, but to kill every man, woman, and child in the city, that's something that is troubling. And I think I would like to discuss it, but I can't tell you that I have, you know, solid answers. I can make suggestions as to the significance that I find from this. But what I do want to point out is that in Hebrew, the word for proscribed in verse 17, the word in 18, it's you, that which is subscribed, lest you be prescribed, is all the same word. It's called cherem, okay? And then in verse 21, the word that you may have in your Bible as they exterminated everything in the city, that too is exactly the same Hebrew word, cherem. Essentially, we have an interplay here of two different words in Hebrew. We have a word cherem, which I'll explain in a minute what that means or what it can mean. And on the other hand, we have kodesh, which is holy, okay? And they're connected because we learn in, verse 19, on the one hand, earlier we say, we cannot use any of the silver or gold. All that has to be prescribed. And in verse 19, we learn that the silver gold objects are consecrated, are holy to the Lord. So there's something about, on the one hand, this cherem, not to take or use these items, and at the same time, the fact that they are then holy to the Lord. Now, the word cherem, before I discuss what the word means, I want to go look at another place in the Bible where that same word is used. And that's in Deuteronomy 20. I'm not just reviewing this because the same word is used, but because this is Deuteronomy 20, verse 10, this really lays the foundation for the laws of battle in the conquest of the land of Israel. So let's read this, okay? This is Deuteronomy 20, verse 10. When you approach a town to attack it, you shall offer it terms of peace. If it responds peaceably and lets you in, all the people present there shall serve you as forced labor. If it does not surrender to you, but would join battle with you, you shall lay siege to it. And when the Lord your God delivers it into your hand, you shall put all its males to the sword. You may, however, take as your booty the women, the children, the livestock, and everything in the town, all its spoil, and enjoy the use of the spoil of your enemy, which the Lord your God gives you. Thus you shall deal with all towns that lie very far from you, towns that do not belong to nations hereabout. In the towns of the latter peoples, however, which the Lord your God is giving you as a heritage, you shall not let a soul remain alive. No, you must proscribe them, the Hittites and the Amorites, the Canaanites and the Perizzites, the Hivites and the Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you, lest they lead you into doing all the abhorred things that they have done for their gods, and you stand guilty before the Lord your God. So in verse 17, here it says, you must proscribe them, when really what this saying is, you must destroy them. It's the same word, though. It's that same cherem. You must destroy them. In the English translation, I'm not quite sure when it decides to use the word destroy and when it decides to use the word prescribe. But clearly here in verse 17, it's not talking about prescribing them or saying like you can't talk to them or putting them in a separate place. It's destroying them. Okay. These verses have created a lot of question, of course, because we're going back to the same issue. Is God telling us that we have to murder every man, woman, and child that lives in the land of Israel? Now, actually, if you look carefully at these verses, it is a bit unclear what's going on. It's clear that when you go to a city and you sue for peace, if they respond peacefully, then you can leave them alone. They need to be subservient to you. And Jewish tradition says that means they must get rid of their pagan gods. In other words, the law of the land of Israel is a belief in one God, not pagan worship. And therefore, you know, becoming subservient to you means getting rid of the pagan gods, but they can live and etc. However, if they don't agree and to peace and they fight, then you kill all the men, but you can keep the women and the children and the spoils for you. Okay. But this verse 15 is the clicker. This is the one we don't really understand. This is what you should do for all those cities that are far from you, but those cities that are within the land of Canaan, that area which you are actually supposed to conquer and settle, there, this does not apply. What here doesn't apply? Okay. Does this mean that you do not even sue for peace when you're talking about Canaan? Or does it mean you sue for peace, and if they don't accept peace, if the nations are further away, you only kill the men. But when you're in the land of Israel, you don't let anyone live. And that's verse 16. Okay? There are those who interpret it as saying, no, you don't sue for peace at all if you're talking about the people of Canaan. Okay? And it's very possible that one of the reasons they interpret it that way is because of what happens in Jericho. We don't see Joshua sending a message to the town saying, you know, these are our terms, surrender or we will fight. Okay. On the other hand, it may be that that was totally unnecessary because Joshua, the king knows they're coming and the response of the king is not to respond in peace, but to close the city up. Okay. The response of the king earlier was to chase to put his whole army to chase those two spies. The prevailing interpretation, however, in Judaism is that you do sue for peace everywhere, whether it's a far country or whether it's in the land of Israel. The difference is if they respond with war. If they respond with war in the land of Israel, then you're killing them all. If they're responding with war further away, then you just kill the men or you know, the soldiers, the people that are actually threatening you. Okay. We'll notice at the very end of that section we just read in verse 18, we have the reason for all of this. Lest they lead you into doing all the abhorrent things that they have done for their gods, and you stand guilty before the Lord your God. And this is a theme that we see repeated a number of times in the book of Deuteronomy. The fear of what will happen to the nation of Israel when they come into the land of Israel and are exposed to horrible pagan ways. And here I would say, and you can see this from some of the descriptions of pagan worship that we see in Deuteronomy and also later on with the prophets, that it's not just a question of do they believe the right or wrong thing, okay? It's the activities and the behavior and the morality or lack of morality that accompanies that pagan worship. It's the worship that includes sexual morality, immorality, the worship that includes murders, child sacrifice, some of the most abhorrent behaviors from a moral point of view. So it's not just, you know, you believe the wrong thing. It's what the civilization is all about. And it's a civilization steeped in pagan worship, pagan activities. And this is something that is a huge threat to the nation of Israel. And when we look at Jericho, when we look at, you know, this chapter that we're discussing now, and this idea of completely destroying Jericho, Many of the Jewish commentators see this as well. What we're talking about is a city steeped in pagan worship, and is a city that represents that alternative civilization. I mean, if you think about it, the Israelites are coming into the land of Canaan with a completely different civilization. And it is their civilization that needs to prevail. And when you have a clash of civilizations, it's not just a question of, did this individual do something wrong that he needs to die, but how can we uproot this other civilization from amongst us so that it does not continue to grow and to create problems and to influence this counter-civilization, the civilization of the belief in the one God of Israel, the Israelite civilization. And so this is clearly part of what's going on here. So when we come into this battle of Jericho, and if we see the way we interpreted the king of Jericho and his behavior, he's not just defending a city, he is fighting God. He seems to be alone in his assessment or in his understanding that he can fight God. And therefore, he becomes the most dangerous. This is a city that is a huge challenge to the ability of the Israelites to wipe out that sort of civilization and create something better, something holier, something more moral in its stead. So let's go back now to this word cherem, okay? Cherem, as we saw in Deuteronomy 20, clearly means to destroy. But the word cherem itself is more accurately translated as proscribed, or, you know, I don't even like proscribed. That's not a good word. It really means kind of set aside. It has to be put somewhere on its own, set aside with its own category and its own treatment, okay? So you can set it aside for holiness. You can say, this is, you know, all hands off of the spoils. They are a cherem. They have to be set aside because they are going to be holy. They're going to be for God. And therefore, there is a total prohibition against any of the Israelites going and touching and helping themselves to those spoils. That's one part of the cherem. But the other part of the cherem is that these certain people are set aside for destruction. So the word itself means set aside, but it can be for holiness and it can be for destruction. And actually, the two seem to go together in this context, certainly, because you are setting aside Jericho because you are recognizing it as a city that has set itself aside as an opponent to God. And once they have done it, they are actually setting themselves up as the opposite or the key combatant against God's holiness. And therefore, once they're in that position, they are setting themselves against God's holiness. They are going to fight God in this holy war. The only way to destroy, to defeat them is to destroy them. They have set themselves aside. They have not opened themselves up for any options of peace, accommodation, nothing. Okay. It's an all-out war, and an all-out war of this kind is a war to the finish. Now, if you'll notice in Deuteronomy 20, even when we talked about these cities that are not willing to have peace, we still only talked about killing the men. They didn't talk about, you know, and being able to use the spoils. There are many commentators, therefore, that see that what this story, what Jericho really resembles more closely, is the story of a banned city or a, I don't know what actually it is in English, but it's a city that has been set aside for destruction because of their behavior. Now, this is in Deuteronomy 13. This is actually a very strong rule also about coming into the land of Israel. And it's about a situation where there are a few people that convince an entire nation worship pagan gods, okay? If your brother, your own mother's, this is Deuteronomy 13, verse 7. If your brother, your own mother's son, or your son or daughter, or the wife of your bosom, or your closest friend entices you in secret, saying, come, let us worship other gods. Okay, that's how it begins. But then we get in verse 13 to a situation, not just of an individual who has been swayed, but an entire city. If you hear it said of one of the towns that the Lord your God is giving you to dwell in, that some scoundrels from among you have gone and subverted the inhabitants of their town, saying, come, let us worship other gods whom you have not experienced. You shall investigate and inquire and interrogate thoroughly. If it is true, if the fact is established that a poor thing was perpetrated in your midst, put the inhabitants of that town to the sword, put its cattle to the sword, doom it and all that is that it is in it to destruction. And here the word is doom it, but again, it's the same word of cherem, okay? Gather all its spoil into the open square and burn the town and all its spoils, a holocaust to the Lord your God. Holocaust, well, that's interesting. Not sure why. Okay, and it shall remain an everlasting ruin, never to be rebuilt. This reminds you very much of what happens in Jericho. Everyone is killed, all the spoils are burnt, and Joshua himself says no one should ever rebuild Jericho, which is exactly what is the situation in Deuteronomy 13. Now, clearly, this is not really Deuteronomy 13, because Deuteronomy 13 is talking about an Israelite city. After they're in the land, after they've settled, a city that maybe has succumbed to these pagan influences that we're so scared of right now, okay? But what the commentary is saying, while it's not technically this kind of a city that's being put, you know, that's being destroyed and burned to the ground, that tells us something. Because the situations are so similar, it tells us that, like in that city here in Jericho, it was a city immersed in pagan worship, immersed in immoral behavior. So this is the same idea that we were discussing until now, but this is just one more way to see that through the text, how if comparing this text to what we saw in Deuteronomy 13, we're able to make that connection of pagan worship. Now, one thing though I want to clarify here, and this is very, very important before we take, you know, if we go forward. Again, I don't have all the answers. This is not necessarily an answer. I'm looking for meaning. But if there's one thing that disturbs us when we think of the idea of destroying an entire nation, okay, an entire, all the residents of a city, we have to ask ourselves, there wasn't an innocent person anywhere. Maybe there's somebody who would have changed, you know, the way they saw things. And the answer to that, of course, is Rahab. There was somebody who was different. It was a redeemable situation, but only one person stood up. And that's Rahab and her family. And by gathering them in with her, she is saying, we are not like these people. We are putting ourselves in the other camp, in the camp of Israel. And I think that tells us in general that this is not a situation of everybody is killed no matter what. Everyone has that ability to redeem themselves, to stand up. And the same way that Rahab, in her very brave way, said, I'm staying against the king. I'm not like the rest of them. I'm putting my lot with the camp of Israel. So too could have anyone else in Jericho, but they didn't. So it's not just random wholesale slaughter. It is, you know, something that there was opportunity for redemption, but the other people did not choose that. And just, you know, what we have at the very end, we have about Rahab. We have here, where are we? Okay, in verse 22, in our same chapter, verse 22, and we see how the spies came to Rahab's house to save her. And what did they do with her initially? In verse 23, they took her, they put her outside of the camp of Israel. They saved her, but they weren't quite sure what to do with her. Is she going to be part of the camp of Israel or not part of the camp of Israel? So initially they take her out of Jericho, but they keep her outside the camp of Israel. But then we see in verse 25, only Rahab the harlot and her father's family were spared by Joshua along with all that belonged to her. And she dwelt among the Israelites to this very day. When the war was over, Joshua came and said, no, she doesn't belong outside the camp of Israel. She belongs inside the camp of Israel because she made this very clear decision. She made the decision to stand with the Israelites and to join the camp of Israel. That's it for today. As always, I go over a few minutes. I hope you don't mind, but anyone who wants to say anything, open your mics, happy to entertain any questions or comments.
Sandra, is it true that Joshua married Rahab?
That is Jewish tradition, yes. That's told to us in the Midrash, in the Talmud. It is not mentioned in the Bible. In the Hebrew scriptures, there's no mention after this of Rahab. We don't know anything more about her, but the Jewish tradition says that Joshua not only took her into the camp of Israel, but married her. And that among their descendants were a number of priests, including Jeremiah the prophet, who was also a priest. So that's interesting. I know that in the New Testament, Rahab has other descendants, whatever.
Yeah, she is said to have married a man called Salmon and was the mother of Boaz, who married Ruth.
Right. So that we don't have that tradition, but
it's interesting. There must be some way. There must be some way, though, that those traditions would combine somehow, don't you think?
Well, you know what? I think both traditions are saying that this was a righteous woman. And it really follows with what we're saying. You know, she didn't just do a technical act and save these people and therefore, you know, say, okay, I'm going to save you and this is my payment. All right.
Right.
Which is what you'll see very often, people who are double agents or who change sides in a war or whatever. They don't have ideological feelings. They're looking for money. They're looking to side with the winners. Okay. But in both traditions, you have this idea that she was truly a righteous woman, and therefore she comes into the camp and she ends up being the mother of, no matter how you put it, very important righteous people.
Yes.
So, you know.
Yeah. Interesting. Could this killing off the people and burning the city in any way be considered part of a sacrifice?
Well, I don't think so, because God says very often, particularly like in Jeremiah, you know, Jeremiah is fighting against people that think they can do whatever they want, and then they just bring the sacrifice and all is fine, right? Mm-hmm. So God says there over and over again, God doesn't need your sacrifices, but the sacrifice is for you, okay? So in this case, there's no way I can understand this sacrifice being for the perfect person being sacrificed or for their families, because they're not in the game. They don't believe in God. They don't. So nobody would be sacrificing there. It would be a need to eradicate a very bad, problematic influence.
I see it as similar to Noah in the flood.
Yes. And Sodom.
And Ezra,
I was thinking about Sodom and Gomorrah for sure.
Sodom and Gomorrah, where you have the same idea where Abraham is arguing for the city. How can you kill a whole city? Abraham says, okay. Mm-hmm. And God says, well, you know, find me a righteous one. Find me righteous. You know, see if there is somebody. God is saying from the beginning, I'm happy to save, you know, even the whole city if there are enough righteous people. And in the end, the only righteous people are Lot and his family.
Right.
And so they get pulled out of the city. And so it's very similar to the way Rahab gets pulled out of the city while the rest of them are destroyed.
Yeah. This is more similar.
All right. Anyway, wonderful to see you all. And I look forward to seeing you again next week.
Thank you.
Have a great week. Bye-bye.
I hope you enjoyed that video. And we'd like to be sure you're getting all of our video content. So just click on the subscribe button below, as well as on the notification bell. And that way you will have easy access to all our material. We look forward to staying in touch with you. God bless you and have a wonderful day.